right, the Andy Finn Show is back, and I want to talk a little bit more about science and then education. And in the world of science, the Nobel Prizes were given out. The first three were given out this week. The first one went to two Australians. This was the Nobel Prize in Medicine, who discovered in 1982 that ulcers weren't caused by stress. Peptic ulcers were not caused by stress, which everyone believed. They were caused by bacteria. Now, that's a huge breakthrough in science and very interesting stuff. Because the common wisdom was that stress caused ulcers. And how did stress cause ulcers? Well, what happens is the stomach is muscle, and the stomach lining is coated with mucus that protects the muscle of the stomach, the flesh of the stomach, from being eaten by the enzymes that are in your stomach. They're very powerful enzymes that break down food in your stomach. And when the mucus coating, the coating is gone off the stomach, then the stomach can eat itself. That is, the enzymes attack the stomach wall itself and causes ulcers. It tries to eat the wall of the stomach. And the reason they believed it was caused, these things were caused by stress, is the flight or fight reflex. That is, when you get panicked in a situation, let's suppose you're out in the woods and you see a bear coming after you. Well, that's the flight or fight reflex. If you think you could fight him off, you will. Otherwise, you're going to run like hell. And most likely, without a gun, you're going to run like hell. The point is that all your energy, all your blood flows to your extremities so that you can take action. And it denies blood to the visceral organs that would perform normal functions like secreting mucus to coat the stomach. So there's less mucus secreted. The stomach walls are exposed when you have stress. That's the principle. That's what was people always operated under. And it turns out the Australians discovered that, in fact, it was a bacteria that caused the ulcers. Now, isn't it the other things aren't a factor? That's the nature of science. These things are complex. But a major discovery, so they got $1.7 million for their discovery this week and the adulation of the people that pay attention to these things, which ain't the average citizen, of course. The second prize was in physics. It was announced on Tuesday, and two Americans and a German won this. And they basically did pioneering work on the behavior of light and how you could harness light to make really precise measurements up to a precision of 15 decimal points. And if you talk about 15 digits in a number, we're talking 15 digits takes you out to the quadrillion range. So they're saying they could get these distances down to 1/4, which is quite small. This is the basis, this work was the basis for quantum optics, a new field that we didn't have before. And they can actually study the structure of atoms. Of course, atoms are not the smallest particles we know of now. There are now subatomic particles that have been discovered over time. But atoms are pretty darn small. And so these three folks won the Nobel Prize in Physics this week for their work that basically started the field of quantum optics. And then yesterday, Wednesday, the third Nobel Prize was announced for the week, and that was the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And this went to two Frenchmen and an American. And basically, they discovered a variety of processes. They each discovered something different, but they discovered different processes that make creating synthetic substances much easier and has many practical applications in the area of creating synthetic drugs, synthetic plastics, and other kinds of chemicals. This work was done in the early 70s, and one of them discovered the process called metathesis, which basically, in chemical terms, is the equivalent of changing places, having molecules change places. And once they figured out how to do that, they were able to apply it in a variety of different places. So those are the three most recent, or the first three prizes, Nobel Prizes, given out in physics, chemistry, and medicine for the year. The other thing I want to talk about here is some scientific discoveries that were reported this week. The first is that gorillas have been seen in the wild using tools. Now, this is revolutionary. Scientists have never seen this before. I guess we just weren't watching close enough. But basically, it's possible to see, to teach animals, mostly monkeys or gorillas, how to use tools. They can model or imitate the behavior. So the early studies in this area, if I recall them correctly, were a monkey was kept in a cage, and there was a banana hung on a string, but out of his reach. But there was a stick in the cage. And then they had a man come along, a researcher come along, take another stick, and use it to pull the banana on the string over closer until the man could grab the banana. And once the monkey saw him do that, then the monkey could do it. But on their own, the monkey did not come up with use the stick to bring the banana closer. But so you can teach, we've known for some time, you can teach certain animals, certain primates in this case, to use tools in that way. But what they saw here were videotapes in the wild of gorillas that they didn't know knew how to do this. And what the gorilla did was he took a stick and he put it out in front of him to test the depth of the water as he tried to cross a pool of water. Because if it gets too deep, he's going under. And maybe he doesn't know how to swim. Maybe he just doesn't want to get his hair wet. But the point is, they are actually using a stick out in front of him to see if the water's too deep. And then if there's a big drop-off, if the water gets deeper, they don't go out any deeper. That is amazing. It's just like unlike anything they'd ever seen in the wild before, because no human taught them that, we don't think. I suppose it's possible. But you have to assume that that animal either learned it for themselves or they learned it from another gorilla. Another interesting discovery was scientists that were using the Mars Global Surveyor satellite monitoring the Martian surface found new evidence that Mars may have had a Marsquake, similar to an earthquake, but happening on the planet Mars. Because that means geological activity on Mars, that means maybe a hot core, it means a variety of things. But what's interesting is that they had photographs of a particular Martian crater, and the photographs from November of 2003 showed that there were a dozen of these large boulders perched up on the lip of the crater. And when they looked at the pictures a year later, most of those boulders had bounced down, moved down, fallen down to the bottom of the crater. So something happened that moved those boulders. Now, scientists believe when you look at the surface of the moon or the Earth, except for when asteroids hit it, that there's no, the moon or Mars, there's no activity. That is, nothing else could explain. The rotation of Mars cannot explain it. The winds of Mars, the sun beating on Mars, none of that explains rocks moving. So they suspect seismic activity. And that's huge because it has a lot of implications. So I thought that was interesting. The third one is about the fact that carbon dioxide seems to be threatening the growth of coral and coral reefs. Basically, coral grows best in relatively cool temperatures and relatively cool water and under certain conditions. And the more oxygen it is, the better it does, because coral is a living thing. And we know that the ocean actually absorbs carbon dioxide. And so the chemistry of the seawater can actually change when the ocean absorbs minerals or it absorbs elements like carbon dioxide. I'm sorry, it's not an element, it's a compound. And particularly at the surface, this can change. And so basically what they're finding is that carbon dioxide levels are up in certain areas and are expected to increase 200 to 300% in the next 50 to 100 years. And it can't help but affect the ecosystems. Already what they're seeing is the small increases they've measured already are correlated with decreasing growth in coral reefs. So they're worried that, in fact, the warming of the oceans, the absorption of carbon dioxide, ultimately global warming, may very strongly affect coral reefs. Global warming is also tied to tainted oysters. So it turns out that you like to get oysters from cold water, and they don't grow below a certain latitude because the water's too warm. And where they do grow, what happens is they're tainted. That is, they go bad, and they aren't edible. And what they're finding is that when the water gets above 58 degrees or so Fahrenheit, that bacteria can thrive, and that's what taints the oysters. And that's another issue, that is, as the ocean warms, it may very well be that the supply of oysters it goes down, and we'll only find them farther north. We won't find them as far south as we used to find them. We'll have to see about that one. And let's see. Oh, I'm going to skip this one about gamma ray bursts being tied to neutron stars, I think. Basically, I'll just summarize it and say that scientists believe that they have discovered the evidence of a neutron star colliding with a black hole, or else it's two neutron stars colliding. And what happens is they get this huge burst of gamma rays. And they've seen those recently and haven't been sure what they were. We're talking huge amounts of energy, the equivalent of a billion suns. And the last item is from the World Health Organization. It says that 400 million people will die of heart disease, diabetes, and other chronic ailments over the next 10 years, but many of them could be prevented by lifestyle changes. And it goes on to explain what percentage it thinks. Like 39 million deaths from these chronic diseases could be prevented if, in fact, people take action. And, of course, we tend not to take action. I guess I want to wrap up this segment on science by saying that when we talk about things like this, and you think in terms of a neutron star billions of light years away colliding with a black hole and sending out the energy of the equivalent of 1 billion, a burst the equivalent of 1 billion suns, when we talk about these discoveries in medicine and chemistry and physics that got people the Nobel Prizes, when we talk about the fact that scientists can now measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the ocean and its changes over time, when we put cameras in the wild and see gorillas doing things we never did before, all of this takes place, gets reported in the scientific literature. And it's only if you document what you find, check it twice, essentially, then send it out to be published. And they don't publish things the way people publish blogs. If you write a scientific article, it's read by three of your colleagues. They critique it and say, well, you know, I think you're misquoting this guy, or you're misusing that theory, or run this statistical test on your data. I'm not sure the data is reliable. And then the person edits the paper, sends it back to the journal editor. Eventually, after a period of about a year of a couple back and forths, that paper can be published if it meets standards of proof and standards of science. That is the conversation that scientists have. And so this stuff doesn't make the newspapers, and I don't bring it to you until we know that, in fact, there's some basis for saying that this is true. This is not like publishing a blog or getting on the radio like I do, or some conservative talk show host does, and saying, well, I think the following is true. I think there's a correlation here. I don't believe this piece of evidence. And so every time you hear somebody say they doubt something about science, always be cautious about that, because the scientists that have put forth the theories and have developed the models, whether it's global warming or evolution or watching gorillas use tools for the first time in the wild, they have been through a rigorous process. They have done evaluations. And so these are what are known as informed opinions. And so always take with a grain of salt when somebody says, I don't believe that research. Because it may be that the research could be wrong down the road. But most of us base our views on opinions. And we just say, I believe this, I don't believe that. Whereas science builds up their volume of knowledge based on studies and replication of studies and peer review and standards of proof that the average Joe, like you and me, don't apply in our daily lives. And so I just would caution you, every time you hear somebody say, I don't believe this or that study, ask them how much they actually know about the topic. A lot of times, it is, to use a scientific phrase, diddly squat.